Mark Pesce's been listening in. He's a futurist, writer, educator and broadcaster. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Certainly, tech can make a lot of exciting things happen if only various sectors would let us get our hands on it and use it. All right. What's happening at the moment, though, is a good old scrap between China and the United States again over technology. And it's tit for tat, isn't it, Mark?
It really is. So we've seen the U.S. pushing back or pulling back on the kinds of technology that, we're allowed to sell into China, particularly high-end AI equipment. And the Chinese have actually been building some of their own, but that's part of a much broader trend. And the Chinese themselves have been developing a buy local strategy. So some of the biggest technology companies in the world, and Microsoft, which is the biggest company in the world right now, for a company that makes around $300 billion a year in revenue, only 1.5% of that now is coming from China. And 10 years ago, that was much more. And you can take a look at Apple, you can take a look at Tesla, you can take a look at Hewlett Packard. There are so many companies, and what you see is exactly the same thing. China has decided that they're going to source locally. They're going to build their own phones so people don't need iPhones. They're going to build their own operating systems so they don't need Windows. They're going to build their own electric cars and sell them to the rest of the world. And this has now started to affect the bottom lines for all of these very powerful and mostly American domiciled companies.
All right. So what might come next, do you think?
Look, we're clearly seeing that migration away, and we're seeing that the United States is not interested in changing its trade policy toward China, which makes China much more reliant on its own internal resources. So I think what we're going to see is effectively two tech spheres. We're already seeing it happening, but I think by the time we get to the end of this decade, the Chinese will be using very much their own native equipment and technologies that they have developed. And then ROW, the rest of the world, will be using ones that are probably dominated by America.
How much of this do you believe is about genuine security concerns and intelligence concerns? And that runs two ways, right? And how much of it is a trade? War is getting a bit strong, but a trade issue, competition issue.
You ask a very good question. I think it's very hard to get to the bottom. We know that Huawei makes a lot of telecoms equipment, and they are basically banned from the Five Eyes countries, New Zealand and Australia, both in the Five Eyes, because it's believed that that equipment was being used to subvert the networks for the Chinese government. So every time that comes up as an issue, there's some security people who brief some politicians, and the politicians come out white-faced and go, oh my God, yes, we have to pass this law. So we think that there's a history there. China also believes that some of the software it was sold by America was used to spy inside of China. So there's clearly a perception on both sides that there is a national security threat there. But some of it, of course, is really just mercantilism. It's just a regular trade war, just like we have all the time.
US automakers are sharing driving data with insurance companies. How fancy and up-to-date does your car have to be when it can spy on you like this?
So most modern cars will have some sort of app associated with them or have an in-dash driver system so you can call for help. GM has OnStar, but there's a bunch of companies, Honda, Kia, Hyundai. They all have these systems, and these systems track the car's telemetry, where it's going, how fast it's going, how fast it stops, how many trips you make, and all of this. And it turns out that probably when you're clicking through all of the I accept things, when you're setting up these systems, you are also acknowledging that your data is going to be shared with a company that's going to sell that to your insurance provider. So your insurance provider can say, oh, I don't think we like the way you drive. You'll have to pay double for your premiums. And this has started to become an issue. New York Times did a big expose about it last week. And it looks really bad because most of the people who are contributing the data to these programs had no idea that they actually allowed their data to be shared with anyone, much less their insurance companies.
Someone's gone so far as to sue the company they bought their car off.
Yes, and I mean, and he says, look, he really says, I don't recall submitting to this, right? I don't recall how I enrolled in this. And so If that's the case, and these agreements are so subtle and so embedded in the normal systems, and there's some cases where we think that at when they're picking up the car at the showroom, that the salesman is just helping them set up the car and they're just clicking accept without knowing that this means all of their data is going to be shared, that this is so embedded in the relationship we have with our cars now that people are doing this unwittingly. And if they knew, and if it were easier to stop, they would turn it off.
This is OnStar in particular, the GM one, the guy that's suing General Motors. So what, could you be a bit more specific about what it actually does record? Is it braking times or braking speed limits? Like what can it know?
So yes, it is, you know, whether you're braking rapidly, so whether the car is decelerating rapidly, acceleration, if you're going over 80 miles an hour, what is that sort of 130, 140 Ks an hour, it will record that because that's above the speed limit. So it basically is tracking the quality of your driving and also your distances driven and how frequently you're driving.
How does it know your speed limit in different parts of the city, or is it just set at the max?
It's really interesting because most modern vehicles, I've certainly been in a range of Toyotas that seem to know the speed limit everywhere I'm driving and tells me when I've gone over it. Some of that's embedded in the maps that the telemetry systems that these cars use integrate large amounts of data. But I think in this case, it's just if you're going over 80 miles an hour and there are no speeds, I think, except maybe in the American Far West where that would be permitted.
I mean, if you brake suddenly successfully, that can be a good thing or a bad thing. Look, just back to it though, because I mean, I've got an old car and it's got a bit of computer in it, but I don't think it can quite track me like that. You mentioned setting them up. So with some of these newer vehicles, are they seriously so full of computers that you actually need to fire them up like you do a new smart TV or something?
The answer is yes. And if you think about it, a lot of the cars will have the navigation system in the dash, right? And even there, you have to click accept every time you turn the car on so that the car will use its navigation stuff. And so a lot of these systems, if it has CarPlay or anything like that, which is a lot of or Android Play, a lot of cars these days will have that so you can hook your smartphone in. Again, the closer it gets to a smartphone integration and that kind of help integration, the more likely it is that it will have these kinds of features.
And once it's, you know, once it and the phone are talking to each other, it'll be moving at your emails as well. All right, let's really freak people out. The AI election, there's already bits of this happening, right? What do we know so far?
So, this week, Google, which has a Gemini AI chatbot, announced that its chatbot can now no longer be used for national election information in 2024. Because we've got an election coming up in India, we've got an election coming up in America, probably one coming up in the UK. So we have all of these elections coming up, and people, we don't want chatbots being used to spread disinformation. They're going to start watermarking AI-generated photos so that people can tell that that's going on. So there's a move afoot from the large providers of AI to do what they can to ring fence AI so that it doesn't become a massive engine of disinformation. And all of that is good. It's admirable. There are always going to be use cases that they don't think of. And so people will constantly be poking holes in all of the guardrails that they put around this. So that's something we need to keep our eye on. But then completely aside from that, there is now a new class of apps that do deepfakes. You can grab an app for your iPhone, bring it up, and create a deepfake of Joe Biden or Donald Trump saying whatever you want them to say, and then put it up online.
We need to work together.
And that's an app.
There's no way this could go badly wrong, is there?
We need to work together to fight the rising tide of populism.
Yeah.
Play that
there
again.
You go.
This is a Biden deepfake, is it? Play it again.
Yes.
We need to work together to fight the rising tide of populism.
I don't know. I'm convinced by that, but it's near enough, is it?
It is. It is near enough. And if we think about this, deepfakes were high technology 5 or 6 years ago. We were talking about them. They were in the lab, right? Now it is an app. The thing I found really interesting about the app is the app has a 4 paid version where you get all these different people, famous people that you can voice clone. The only two that are free are Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And to me, that is hilariously the wrong way to have done this. And it almost feels like there needs to be a legal intervention, because if you are really trying to cut down on the amount of disinformation and noise in the political campaign, the one thing you don't want is to have an app that allows them to do those specific two people for free.
Is it audio only, this app, or is it vision as well?
Oh, no, it's vision as well.
Okay.
Vision is not quite as close, but it's not bad.
That there's no law against. It just goes to show how slow the lawmakers have been with what we all know is coming. I mean, to just be able to completely pretend and convincingly pretend to be someone you're not and saying something they haven't said, particularly when that person is running for president, it's not like we're watching some satire on TV. No. We know what we are watching, right?
No. And I mean, again, you then go, okay, well, how did Apple let this get through the App Store? Because Apple is then the next level of guardrails. I mean, yes, there are the laws around this, but what about Apple? Wouldn't Apple say, actually, this is probably not the direction for products that we want to see for people in America, so we're not going to let it in the App Store?
Well, and I again, think the you law get is free a good starting speech point issues. About, you know, not having completely fabricated but completely convincing presidential campaigns. It was interesting. Yeah. I was talking to Jeffrey Hinton on Friday, the former Google, well, he's a legendary kind of computer scientist who invented did the first work on neural networks, and then his startup got bought by Google. And this is exactly his point. He says, we need to have a watermark. It needs to be like running counterfeit money. You need consequences if you do not have a watermark saying this is not the real thing. But what do you think the odds are of that arriving anytime soon?
Well, I mean, it's easy enough to watermark audio, but the problem is that audio is not detectable to someone who's just listening to it. You can put it through a program. They'll say, yes, this audio is watermarked.
You can get an AI to say this is watermarked. You could. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And maybe that's what your phone should be doing all the time when you're playing audio through it. It'll say, oh, I've detected that this is AI generated.
Maybe that's what we got to do. I don't know. Mark, as always, mind expanding talking to you. Mark Pesce.